Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument, E360 Insight versus Spam House. Mr. Martin.
May it please the court, my name is Craig Martin. We represent Spam House, a volunteer spam watchdog organization based in the UK.
Why are you representing it pro bono? That seems so unusual. We have an institutional client of pro bono.
It's the equivalent of a, as I understand it, Your Honor, of a 501c3 not-for-profit. But
no, I know it's not, but I can't remember ever seeing some pro bono appearance for an institution. Is it small? What is it?
It is small.
We're basically not told anything about it, so what
sure.
is it?
It's basically an organization that consists of...
No, I know what it is. So how many people work for it?
I understand that it's a very small staff, that it's in the range of about 5 people to 10 people.
Oh, okay. So it is tiny. So they can't afford to lawyers and so on.
Yeah, and then I further understand that there are many volunteers that work for it or do work for it. So it's basically an anti-spam organization that is based in the U.K., and we represent as part of our pro bono program both indigent clients as well as corporations that would be 501c3 type of clients.
So the other thing, of course, is peculiar is an appeal what has become a $27,000 case. So if you weren't handling it pro bono, there wouldn't be an appeal, right? No one appeals $27,000 to the Court of Appeals.
I don't know the answer to that question in terms of whether this particular client could even pay
$27,000
judgment. And the principle, there's a very clean principle with regard to the appeal. And if you don't mind, I'd like to turn to that
principle.
Yeah,
sure, of course.
But let me, Your Honor, I have 2 things that I need to correct for the record, which I'm embarrassed to correct, but there's 2 mistakes in our brief. One is on page 8 of our opening brief. There's a chart of E360's ownership structure where it has the company Maverick in bold. Maverick shouldn't have been in bold. It's not a party to the litigation. The second is, and I'm embarrassed by this mistake as well, we cite the Independence Tube versus Copperweld case, the Seventh Circuit opinion, for a routine legal proposition. That case was obviously reversed by the Supreme Court on other grounds, so I just want to correct those for the record.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the point, the main point with regard to this appeal is that the district court and the way this particular case unfolded is we were up here before the Seventh Circuit reversed with regard to damages. The Seventh Circuit sent this case back to the district court for a fuller evidentiary record with regard to any damages findings, specifically instructing the district court on the reasonable certainty standard and the notion that damages could not be speculative. We went back to the district court. There was approximately a year of discovery. During the year of discovery, it took us 4 tries to get the plaintiff's deposition, which was only covered after discovery. We had 2 motions to compel with regard to interrogatory responses specific to the damages. And we also had a motion to dismiss the case based on the misconduct of plaintiffs with regard to the interrogatory responses and other items, which the district court denied, but did some other limitations. So there was a full period of discovery in the district court. We had a 3-day bench trial before Judge Koukouras. After the bench trial, Judge Koukouras essentially ruled that there was $1 of damages on one of the claims, $1 of damages on a second claim, and $27,000 of damages on the third claim. The principal basis of our appeal concerns that $27,000. Judge Koukouras took $27,000 in revenue from 3 customers of Spam House and did no analysis with regard to what the costs were that would be incurred in connection with those customers.
Is there any evidence of any costs, any marginal costs associated with sending the emails?
There is, in the record, there is very little evidence with regard to costs because the plaintiffs did not put on this particular theory. And the evidence, the testimony in the record is that there's cost to send emails, there's cost to get licenses to send emails and data royalty costs, and there's costs associated with client campaigns.
Where do we find that evidence?
Where do you find that evidence? Yes. The specific evidence is on day one of the trial, and it's the closest evidence on that is day one of the trial at pages 46 and 47.
This is evidence presented by the plaintiffs?
Yes, it's direct testimony from the plaintiff about what are the costs generally associated with doing your business. It's not evidence that's specific to these three customers or this $27,000 worth of revenue. So there was no, in the district court, what the plaintiffs did is they presented at trial a damages model that had nothing to do with these three customers for 1 month of revenue. So their damages
They were swinging for the fences.
Correct.
But and struck out. But in terms of Judge Koukouras' approach to this, the thing that concerns me is if we were to agree with you and send this back, I don't think there would be anything that would prevent Judge Koukouras from a kind of rough and ready estimate. We don't demand complete precision, particularly when we're talking about these kinds of dollar values. He could say, let's take a wildly optimistic view and say marginal costs are 50% of the revenues. He'd say, well, but then maybe we ought to look at maybe 2 months worth of the revenues instead of one, right? You guys basically won and you're appealing.
Yes, and you could have a result-oriented remand. But in terms of the relief that we seek from this court is not a remand for further evidence because we've been through a year of discovery. There is no evidence in the record by which the district court or this court could make any determination with regard to the...
You want a remand based on a failure of proof.
Yeah, we want a failure
of proof. You just wanted a reversal based on failure of proof.
Right.
So, okay.
But there's no evidence in the record with regard to any incremental costs associated with this alleged $27,000 in revenue. And
so the evidence consists of Linhart's testimony, I take it. So did he say that the $27,000 was the profit or just the revenue?
He said that
just
it was
lost revenue. No,
he said that it was the revenue from three particular.
No,
customers.
No mention of costs at all.
No mention of costs with regard to that. No analysis of costs, and the reason for that, Your Honor, is twofold. One is, as I said, they were swinging for the fences, and they put on a completely different damages theory. The second, and it goes to another basis for which we object to the testimony with regard to these three customers, is that there's a lengthy history of discovery misconduct from the appellee. And part of the discovery misconduct comes after the close of discovery. And it's the third argument in our opening brief. After the close of, and we had asked many times for what are the damages, and the answer that we got during discovery was these pie-in-the-sky numbers. When it came to the close of discovery, after the close of discovery, and in response to a summary judgment motion in early 2009, Mr. Linhard submitted a declaration or an affidavit. And the affidavit identified this $27,000 worth of revenue from these three customers for 1 month. And then attached to the affidavit was a particular document, which was not an invoice or anything. It was a compilation document. And the compilation document was a list of customers with numbers, numbers associated with them. We couldn't track those numbers to any invoices. We moved before the district court to strike that affidavit and strike that evidence because we said, look, it's after the close of discovery. We've been through it. Please strike it under Rule 37. The district court struck it under Rule 37. So the district court struck the affidavit, and the district court struck that exhibit. So our point, one of the points that we make in our brief is essentially he should not be allowed to rely upon the very same testimony and the very same document that he relied upon in the district court, which the district court struck under Rule 37 as a sanction with regard to those three particular customers and those three particular revenue numbers, because we had absolutely no discovery with regard to that. So the types of questions that we might have asked somebody about what are the incremental costs, what are the marginal costs, what are your fixed costs, et cetera, the analysis that we and our expert would have gone through, who, by the way, is also pro bono, the analysis that we and our expert would have gone through, we couldn't do. We were foreclosed from doing that with regard to this evidence. And we make it clear in our brief, and you can see from the district court transcript, that during the trial, what happened and how this evidence came out is very clear. What happened during the trial is Exhibit 8 was shown to the plaintiff, and it was the attachment to that affidavit. It wasn't an invoice. It was the attachment to the affidavit, the summary chart that was stricken from discovery. With that document in front of him, Mr. Lindhart blurted out those numbers, and that became the basis by which the $27,000 got into the record. So we think that the very basis by which it got into the record is also an error.
But you mean the affidavit?
Yeah. Well, I mean the testimony, because the testimony is just taken, is exactly the same
as the affidavit.
It's the testimony.
Don't we count on district judges, though? You can keep out a document, but it's pretty tough to limit testimony in that way. And we count on district judges in bench trials to sort these things out reasonably well.
Yes. However, this is a little bit different than just letting the district court sort it out. And the reason we think that it's different is because in this instance, the district court, going back into the history of the case, had specifically stricken that testimony and had specifically stricken that particular document that was, you know, put in front of the witness to refresh his recollection. So that's why we make this point on appeal. We think it's clear error to have stricken that and then allowed that testimony during the trial in the manner that it came in. But the main point with regard to appeal is that you can't have, the law is very clear, and we cite the Taylor case that Your Honor, Judge Posner authored. The law is very clear that you need to do some kind of deduction for costs when you're going to do lost profits. And in this case, there's just no analysis of it whatsoever in the record. And in fact, in the opposing briefs, there's no discussion at all of the Taylor case. There's no response to it. There's no response whatsoever. And the law is crystal clear on that point. Now, the third point that I just want to make briefly is that the books and records of E360 were commingled with eight other companies. And that was the point in our brief is essentially that Maverick had eight other entities, and the books and records of E360 are commingled. And in fact, Judge Koukouras, in the opinion, finds that E360's profits over 5 years were Maverick's profits over 5 years were $332,000 in total, and basically says E360's profits must have been, if any, some subset of that. So in a commingled situation where the books and records are commingled, you can't do the appropriate loss
years,
profits.
In 5 years, how many of them, or were any of them before Spam House did anything? Or was it all after?
I want to answer that question, but it's very difficult for me to tell from the record whether the lost profits are before or after or in the midst of. So I don't want to mislead uh-huh. you. My basic read is that they occur both before and after, and most of them occur after. And they're not profits of E60. They're profits
right,
on average.
Right, I understand that.
So
okay.
Profits on a consolidated basis. Finally, I should note that Judge Koukouras, in his opinion, and in we filed a motion for reconsideration on this $27,000 because we wanted to flesh that issue out before bringing it here. Judge Koukouras, both in his original opinion and in the motion for reconsideration, acknowledges very clearly that he does no measurement of costs. So with regard to that, we think that you should take the $27,000, reduce it to $1, do not remand for a new trial with regard to costs, because that was what you did essentially the first time. You sent us back down for a full evidentiary hearing with regard to that. With that, I'll go ahead and sit down. I think I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Kish?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Joseph Kish on behalf of David Linhart and E360. Your Honors, I'd like to point out a record site that we miscited. It's page of our opening brief, page 35. We cite towards the bottom there to the appendix at page 12. It actually should be the appendix at page 32. Page 12 was the actual page of the deposition. So I just wanted to bring that to the Court. Your Honors, the points that I want to make are somewhat in response to Mr. Martin's arguments. First of all, I think both Spam House and particular...
What about the costs of serving these three customers? What's the evidence of that?
That's exactly my point. Essentially, Your Honor, there are no marginal costs, and that's the major disconnect.
Okay, what's the evidence there are no marginal costs?
It's basically the fact that...
What is the evidence?
The evidence is Mr. Linhart's testimony.
And what did he say?
He says essentially that once the emails are sent, there's no further cost. The only costs are associated with emails that are yet to be sent, that are going to be sent. This case, the entire...
Well, there must be a billing expense, right, if there are clicks and so on. You got, right?
Not really, Your Honor.
His purpose in emailing these people is the hope that he will derive some revenue from it. Doesn't he have to keep a record if they respond and, you know, bill them and so on? And
he does, Your Honor.
Yeah, well, that's in a cost. That's an expense.
All right, but those costs are in the scheme of things.
Who cares about the scheme of things? Where's the evidence? Well, you're only entitled to profit. You're not entitled to revenue. If there are costs, whether they're large or small, they have to be deducted.
I understand that. And it's not.
And that's not some novelty of Taylor versus Myrick in 1983. That's just fundamental. You present your revenues and your costs, and the difference is your profit, and that's your damages. You can't just go get up here and not have the cost data.
But can I provide an analogy, Your Honor?
Sure.
And it's this: once the emails are sent, and that's what we're talking about, are emails that have been sent. The reason why you don't get profits but you get the entire revenue is because if you take, for example, a metaphor where I'm shipping goods and they're perishable goods and I'm Company A. Company B does something to block those perishable goods from reaching their destination. What I'm entitled to, because I've already incurred the cost to ship those goods, I've done everything that I'm going to do to get those goods to their destination. I'm entitled to the revenue that I would have gotten for that transaction had it gone through, not just my costs. Because if I only get costs, that doesn't factor into...
We understand the theory.
Okay.
The question is about the evidence that supports that rather unusual theory in this case.
I don't think Mr. Linhart delved into that very deeply, Your Honor, to be honest.
Then he's not entitled to his $27,000.
Well, but I think he is, Your Honor, because what the...
Especially since this... I have never seen such an incompetent presentation of a damages case, it's not only incompetent, it's grotesque. You've got damages jumping around from $11 million to $130 million to $122 million to $33 million. In fact, the damages are probably zero. What was his most profitable year?
I believe it was about $140,000, Your Honor.
And $140,000 is what? That's his profits in 1 year?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Pardon?
I believe so, yes.
And how do you? And how does that get up to $122 million?
Well, because when Spam House came onto the scene, it got to E360 right at the point where it was starting to take off.
Oh, come on. It's going to take off from a... So a company that has net profits of $140,000 a year is probably worth, you know, $1.5 million, $2 million, something like that. And you're going to jack that up to $122 million on the basis of the owner's testimony? Well, how could damages be awarded on such a basis?
Well, Your Honor, the amount of emails that were going out skyrocketed during that same period. So there is a basis for believing that number does go up. Now, the numbers that you're quoting also include things that are no longer on appeal, which are the enterprise value damages.
It doesn't matter that it's no longer on appeal. It is illustrative of the total irresponsibility of the damages case, that there should ever have been a suggestion that his damages were $122 million. Well, actually, it's $130 million, wasn't it, before it got downgraded to $122 million.
Including
that's just totally irresponsible litigation. You can't just come into a court with a fly-by-night nothing company and say, I've lost $130 million.
Well, the reason why I want to bring in the enterprise value.
Well, you defend to me this proposition. Were you involved when he asked for $130 million from the court?
I was not, Your Honor. Your Honor, I want to bring you back, though, to the figures that you're throwing out, because if you back out the enterprise value portion of what was presented at trial, what we're really talking about are numbers in the low $30 million range. Now,
that's also preposterous. I mean, obviously, you'd have to have really scrupulous and deep expert evidence to try to explain how a company that makes $140,000 in its best year has lost $30 million. Right? They have to do that. From a company which can't actually block spam, all it can do is inform the internet companies that they think this is spam. Where's the expert at? Where's someone who looks at across the range of internet marketing companies and say, yeah, $140,000 a year, companies that were earning that 10 years ago, they're worth $1 billion today or something like that, right?
There was not an expert that presented that testimony, Your Honor.
But then how can a court be bothered with such pie-in-the-sky damages estimates without expert evidence?
Well, but what Mr. Linhart did here, Your Honor, he took the actual number of emails that he sent out.
And look, I mean, he just keeps going. Like this 4.79% response rate, there's no evidence for that. The evidence is like a 1% response rate. He's got 4.79% every year, 4.79%, the exact same, you know, click rate, whatever it is. That's ridiculous. How could it be identical to you know, a hundredth of a 1% every year after year? That's just ridiculous.
Mr. Linhart, Your Honor.
I've never seen anything like this.
Mr. Linhart,
how do you justify that 4.79% year after year? Not to mention a sample of 10 companies? That's not a sample. That's not a sample on which you can draw. You can't draw a statistical inference from a sample of 10.
Mr. Linhart testified that he was constrained by the fact that so many of the email messages were being blocked. To get to the 4.79 question that you had, He took that as a result of basically having to average out what he thought the click rate would be based on the email messages that had already gone out.
Where is the evidence that he ever had a 4.79% rate?
It was his calculation.
Where are the papers? Where are the documents? His calculation. What, does he do it in his head?
No, Your Honor, it was...
Well, there would be paper. There would be documents which would show what the rate was. Where are the documents?
It was his calculations in...
Where are the documents? Where are the underlying documents? You don't do this in your head. You don't get the figure 4.79% by a mental calculation.
I understand your point, Your Honor.
Now, what about this sample of 10?
Mr. Linhart testified that he couldn't take a random sample because it would not be random based on a couple of different factors, one of which was...
I'm not talking about randomness. I'm talking about the size of the sample. Can you draw statistical inferences from a sample of 10?
He thought it was representative, Your Honor, and that's what he...
This is a statistical question, right? There are statisticians. They'll look at the pool of data, and they'll say, for this pool, you know, you need to have 100. Now, the smallest sample I've ever heard of was 30, right? 30. I mean, often use a sample of 30. You're going to have a lot of error. But 30, okay, but 10? You can't draw inference from 10. That's why if you had an expert and the expert was asked, is 10 a large enough sample to draw an inference to the universe, the data, the 10,000, whatever it was? And the statistician would say, no, you can't do that. It's too small.
I understand your point, Your Honor. And that Mr. Linhart testified that he took 10. He didn't justify it other than to say that his resources allowed him to take 10. He thought they were representative. He took them from across the spectrum of what he had to deal with.
How did he possibly know that they were representative? And what do you mean his resources? If he had resources to analyze a sample of 10, he could analyze a sample of 30, right?
That was his testimony, Your Honor.
Well, what sense does it make? How is it you can analyze 10, but you can't analyze 30? How long does it take to analyze one? Does it take a week? What are you analyzing?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, and it's not in the record what the efforts would be to analyze any of the data.
Mr. Kish, let me raise with you some concerns I have about the discovery issues that you all have addressed. One, as a general rule, we give a fair amount of deference to a district judge's interpretation of his or her own orders. Would you agree that we should do that?
I think you should, Your Honor.
Frankly, the history of the discovery problems in this case is troubling, especially in light of the proceedings on default, where several years ago you all had the opportunity to step forward, prove your damages. You came up with a number of $11 million with at least some evidentiary support, although not sufficient to survive appellate scrutiny. Given that track record, this history that Judge Posner has referred to with estimates of 135, 122, 30 million destroys the credibility of all the numbers, okay? But what I don't understand is why it was hard to come up with any damages theory since you'd already presented one to the district court. Back before the first appeal.
You're referring to the number contained in the affidavit, Your Honor?
Yes.
I think two things went on there. That affidavit was prepared shortly after the default was entered, and I don't think it got full attention. I think
it's kind of important, isn't it? It gets attention from the courts. Are you telling us it didn't get attention from your client?
No. What I'm saying is I don't think he gathered all of the damages that he possibly could have at that time. I think the methodology was sound. I don't think he gathered all of the damages. And then the other issue was the damages kept increasing as time went on, which is why the numbers kept increasing.
Bouncing all over the place.
That's a different issue, Your Honor, that I acknowledge. But it does explain why the numbers change and why they trend.
And
up.
Why was it so difficult for you all to respond to discovery when ordered to do so?
Your Honor, I don't know that I have a explanation, and I'm not.
If you don't, it's pretty hard to argue that the sanctions were an abuse of discretion.
Well, I do, Your Honor. The thing that I would argue, though, is that I think they were disproportionate to what had happened.
Well, you've got the whole. You all want to focus on one supposedly inadvertent failure to meet one deadline in responding, in complying with the court's order to compel. And the court is remembering the whole history when it decides what those sanctions are. Now, you've got to address that whole history if you want to argue there's an abuse of discretion there. And I'm saying that whole history includes having come forward with a damages theory several years earlier. So what should be so difficult?
Your Honor, again, I think the point was that the damages were increasing as time went on. And Mr. Linhart...
So you take a snapshot, right? It's your case.
Well, I think that's what he did in the affidavit. And then afterward, I think he was chasing those damages. Now, should there have been a point in retrospect where we said, okay, on today...
Like when the court ordered it, right?
When the court ordered it.
Yeah, okay.
Your Honor, I believe my time is up.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Kish.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Martin, your time had expired, but if you have anything further, you can take it. Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.